Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Before he became famous for reaching the South Pole, Roald Amundsen was the first mate on an ill-fated adventure also in Antarctica, one that was so harrowing that a recent book about the excursion is titled Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Its author joins me now. Welcome, Julian Sankton.
Thanks very much for having me.
I wonder about the significance of the ship's name, the Belgique. Was Belgium big in the world of exploring at this period of time? We're talking just before the turn of the 20th century, right?
We are, yeah. The ship left Antwerp in 1897, and Belgium's experience in the world of exploration was limited at that time to the Congo, more or less, which was even then considered to be a pretty, I would say, cruel empire run like a personal fiefdom by King Leopold II. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a colony of Belgium. It was the personal property of Leopold II, or at least he claimed it was. So the idea that a young aristocrat like Adrien de Gerlache, who was the commander of the Belgica, would have his eyes set on the Antarctic was quite unusual. He was at that time, Belgium did not have much of a maritime presence, and he was operating what amounted to a ferry service between Ostend and Dover. He was a captain on a ferry boat. So for a man like that to dream of becoming one of the conquerors of the Antarctic was an unusual fascination. The way he was able to get the funding for this dream of his is to couch it in as a nationalist endeavor, and so that's why, or at least a patriotic endeavor, and that's why he renamed it the Belgica. He also astutely understood that one of the justifications for exploration at that time was science, and so about a couple years before, all the geographical societies of the Western world had gotten together and decided that the utmost priority for exploration was the Antarctic, which at that time was hardly known. It had been 50 years since the last serious expedition, and there had not been a purely scientific expedition to that the southernmost region. So he figured, why not me? Why not Belgium? Well, there were plenty of reasons why not, but they didn't stop him.
Mm. And I think we'll get to those, but set the stage for what the trip was supposed to be and what exactly they were trying to accomplish.
It was supposed to be a thorough scientific program that would document the fauna, the flora of the Antarctic Peninsula, the geology, the ocean temperatures, meteorology, all along the peninsula. So the Antarctic Peninsula, if you remember high school geography, is it looks like this outstretched tendril pointing to South America. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much all that was known of Antarctica at that point. And if you look at maps at that time, it was almost a blank at the bottom of the globe. So part of the mission was to fill that blank. Another mission was something that would be more of an exploit that would electrify the Belgian public back home, and that was the attainment of the South Magnetic Pole, which is the center of magnetic activity in the polar region, which would have been something of a coup. It's a constantly moving target, but there was this sense that it was on the other. It was estimated that it was going to be on the other side of Antarctica. So he would have had to both, according to his initial proposal, both explore the Antarctic Peninsula in detail and then make his way in a very short amount of time to the other side of the continent and reach the magnetic, land a party of four people and who would build wintering quarters, and as soon as the spring would come, would make a dash to the South Magnetic Pole. That was the plan. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, those two odds are goals are at odds. A thorough scientific program demands that scientists take their time and examine things closely and not move from a location for a long time. And then the attainment of this other goal the South Magnetic Pole required sailors to move very quickly before the winter ice set in.
So if you take too long exploring the coastline, you're going to delay yourself being able to get to the to the South Pole, or your ship might get stuck in the ice, I guess is the real problem, right?
Exactly. And de Gerlache was not able to square that circle. By the time he was on his way, he had been delayed by so many unexpected events, from the a near mutiny in South America to the ship running aground in Tierra del Fuego, to the scientists just indulging their curiosity all along the way. And he was at a point where he would either have to go back to Europe with nothing to show for the first year of his campaign, except for obviously a pretty thorough scientific bounty, but nothing that would just that the press could write about. Certainly nothing quite as exciting as the South Magnetic Pole, or he could pursue a relentless southern course, knowing full well what would happen if the when the winter ice would expand and encase the ship.
Well, before you go any further, I'm still kind of stuck on the near mutiny, because maybe doesn't bode well for this crew. So what happened back in South America?
He was not a particularly good leader of men. He was a wonderful sailor, but he was not a disciplinarian. And in addition to that, since it wasn't a military ship or a Navy expedition, he had very few means at his disposal to discipline rebellious sailors. He could kick them off the ship, but he was bound by the fact that he had presented this expedition as a nationalist endeavor. And so, that word means different things now. So I should say patriotic endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
It so happens that the Belgian sailors on board were the ones causing problems. So if you want to kick them off, he would be left with Norwegian sailors who he had hired because of their experience navigating in the ice. He waited too long to kick off the problematic Belgian sailors. And in that time, they had gotten emboldened. They were routinely drunk. They were fighting. They were defying authority. They were shaking him down for money to go ashore and carouse. And he didn't know. He knew that if he said no, that they would they blackmailed him. They said they would go to the press and say that he given preferential treatment to the foreigners, and that he was not sufficiently devoted to the glory of Belgium, which is at the end of the day three sailors came back after 3 days of insulting the commanders, the officers, and just defying orders. And finally, it came to a head, and de Gerlache had to call for the help of the Chilean military to kick them up, to frog march them off the ship.
Mm.
Because he was so afraid of their how they would react, he gave them each £1 as a, I don't know whether it was
like hush money.
It was, yeah, exactly. He said it was to send them on their way, but it was essentially hush money, and it didn't work because while they were stuck in the ice. I mean, I know we'll get there, but while they were stuck in the ice, one of the Belgian sailors went back and gave an interview to a Belgian newspaper. And claimed that de Gerlache had kicked all of the Belgians off the ship. He was assuming that they would never make it back, and that he would get his vengeance.
Mm.
But it was obviously a lie. He had kicked three rebellious sailors and one incompetent mechanic who was so incompetent he did not know how to start even a very simple engine like the one on the Belgica.
Okay, so now we're back to, he's making a decision. He knows if I keep going south, I'm going to get stuck in the ice. Does everybody else on the ship understand that reality?
They do, and they're very much opposed to it. I mean, they were all aware of previous expeditions and that had gotten quite famously stuck in the ice and didn't survive. There was the Franklin expedition in the 1840s. They got ice bound in the Canadian Arctic, and all 130 or so men died. And many expeditions went out to try to find them, and some suffered similar fates. They were aware of the Jeannette that was crushed in the ice and swallowed whole by the pack in the Arctic in the second half of the 19th century. And they were quite aware that to be stuck fast is can be a death sentence. And
there was no ultimate mutiny to say, okay, we are turning this ship around.
No, there wasn't. At that point, the mutinous elements had been kicked off the ship. So no, there wasn't. But there was vocal opposition. And so when de Gerlache was at the fringes of the pack, the moment of truth came when a terrible storm fractured the pack and opened up these avenues to the south, these leads, they're called, that was incredibly tempting to him because he wanted to come home with something to crow about. He wanted either a southern record or to reach land, see or explore, find out if the Antarctic was indeed a continent, or as we now know that it is, or whether it was an ocean of ice, as the Arctic is. This was all unknown. So any progress he could make into the unknown would, for him, have been a victory. And there's the other element that may have gone through his mind, and there's evidence that it did, which is that if he were to sail to the south and the ice were to encase the ship, then they, if they survived, would become the first men to survive a winter in the Antarctic, which would have made for an incredible story to tell and an exciting record to brag about. And
what a gamble, though. I mean,
yeah, a hell of a gamble. And in the field of exploration, when explorers make their name and often make their money by selling these stories of adventure, a good story is as valuable a resource as anything else he could have brought back. That was the name of the game. So it was a hell of a gamble and a very dangerous one, and it cost some lives.
Julian Sancton is the author of Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. So the inevitable happens. He keeps going south. The ship gets encased in ice, and they run up against all kinds of problems. And I want to know, what did they eat? What did they do all day? How cold it was, and how their what their mood was like. But before we get to that, I want you to introduce us to a couple more players, key players here on the crew, and that's the doctor, Dr. Cook, and then, of course, Roald Amundsen.
Yes, these were the two best staffing decisions that de Gerlache made. He made as we've discussed, he made a few bad ones. But right before leaving Antwerp, the third doctor that he had hired, meaning he had hired a string of doctors, all of which were kicked off the expedition or left for some reason. The third doctor said at the very last minute, I actually need to stay here and tend to my ailing sister. It's pretty clear he got cold feet because of the the signs were not pointing to this being a very successful expedition. But that meant that de Gerlache was about to leave for the Antarctic, one of the most hostile environments on Earth, without a doctor. And he ended up deciding to leave. But because he had hired such an incompetent mechanic, there was an engine problem as soon as they left. And they had to come back to Ostend, and that ended up being a life-saving turn of events, because then he thought better of leaving without a doctor and looked at an old telegram that had been sent to him a couple weeks before from a certain Frederick Cook, an American explorer and lecturer and quite a colorful character, who had said, who had attempted to mount his own American Antarctic expedition, but had failed to raise the money. And so he decided, well, it's either join this ragtag bunch of Belgians and Norwegians, or give up on my Antarctic dreams and just become a family doctor. So he had applied to de Gerlache via telegram. And at that point, August of 1897, de Gerlache, out of desperation, accepts the application and made an appointment to meet Frederick Cook in Rio. The other one you mentioned was Roald Amundsen. And at this point, he was 25. He was a Norwegian who grew up outside of Oslo and had dreams of exploration, of becoming a great polar explorer in the mold of his hero, Fridtjof Nansen, the great Norwegian seaman and scientist and explorer. There was another man he revered, and that was John Franklin. And I mentioned him a little while ago as the leader of the expedition to the Arctic that got crushed in the ice. Mm-hmm. It was one of the most horrendous disasters in the history of exploration. And yet for Amundsen, his stories were exciting. The stories of suffering were enticing to him. He wanted to emulate the suffering. He had a masochistic urge.
I guess.
He did. And to inure himself to the cold in preparation for what he assumed was his destiny as a great polar legend, he would sleep at night with the windows down, or the windows open in Oslo in the winter to acclimate himself to the cold. He would walk across with his brother. He'd walk across the fearsome plateau in Norway that was a dead ringer for the Arctic and almost got entombed in snow. And had signed up for several Arctic voyages in order to gain experience of navigation in the ice. So he was already at 25, quite a seasoned explorer. And when he applied, it was de Gerlache met him and saw a 6'2" modern day Viking, you know, of 200 pounds of muscle. He looked like a hero out of the adventure books that de Gerlache read as a child. And so he hired him, and what was very significant is he hired him as first mate. And this, keep in mind, this is a Belgian expedition. It's supposed to be a patriotic endeavor. And to hire a foreign national as a first mate meant that by the maritime custom, should anything happen to the commander or the captain, the first mate would inherit the command of the ship. And this caused a tremendous amount of consternation among the Belgians, who forced de Gerlache to sign a contract in secret that said that this would never happen. No matter what happened to the commander and the captain, the next ranking Belgian would inherit command, and that was something that would cause a lot of grief later on in the ice.
Okay, we'll get to that. So they're stuck in the ice. We've got really interesting cast of characters. Did they have enough food?
They had enough, and the quality was not bad considering the time. All of it was canned by the time. They'd gotten stuck in the ice. No, any of the fresh food that they would have brought with them from South America would have gone bad, and so they were dependent on canned food. But the problem was not so much the quantity, although it was being rationed because de Gerlache was afraid of what the Belgian press would say about them eating too well. He was really obsessed with this. But it was the sameness of the food that got to them. And one reason was because one of the mutineers was a cook, and he had only become the cook because he had beaten the living daylights out of the previous cook. And both of those cooks were kicked off the ship, leaving kitchen duties in the hands of an incompetent cabin boy, well-meaning but culinarily inept. Yeah. And so he couldn't prepare these meals. Not that they were that exciting to begin with, but given them. Monotony of the of icebound life, where you can't even walk outside because you're afraid that the pack will have shifted. I mean, you could, but you need to watch every step. When night sets in early on in their imprisonment and lasts for 70 days, the monotony started to get to these men and
there's no food to comfort them. About like scurvy? And I mean,
well, exactly. That's it. So the food that they did have, they got unbelievably tired of, and that had some psychological effects because meals are supposed to be times that you look forward to, times of conviviality, and they couldn't even have those. But in addition to that, no matter how good the quality of the canned food was, it was still canned food, and in the canning process. Nutrients like vitamin C are broken down, and so after 3 months, of not having vitamin C, sure enough, the men started developing signs of scurvy and possibly even beriberi disease, which is a deficiency of vitamin B1. And so Cook, as a doctor, starts, he doesn't want to say the name scurvy because that inspired dread among sailors and was thought, in fact, to have been a disease of the past. Because people thought that because lemons work to combat scurvy, then bottled lime juice must work as well. But the bottled lime juice was ineffective. The bottling process also broke down the vitamin C. So he was forced to improvise. And that's something he did extraordinarily well. He was, as I hope we will be able to discuss later, he was a man with no shortage of imagination.
Oh, yes. And that, we're going to get there.
yeah. But he... remembered his time among the Inuit of Greenland. He had been on a few expeditions to the Arctic, and he had spent time with the with indigenous people there, and noticed that even though that they didn't have any sign of scurvy, even though they subsisted on a diet consisting almost entirely of meat, fresh game, seal, walrus, etc. And so he decided, well, you know, since nothing that we packed is working, and these men, if they don't, they keep eating what they're eating, will certainly die. Then I need to try something. So he forced them to eat the game of the Antarctic, which is penguins and seals, which at least at the beginning of their imprisonment were there in abundance. And sure enough, for those who were able to stomach penguin and seal steaks, the symptoms of scurvy were reversed as surely as water douses fire. Mm. But not Amundsen, who relished suffering, guzzled them down raw. and he fared among the best. Dzur Lash, however, refused to eat it at first, and when forced to, could only eat it charred to a crisp, which also destroyed the vitamin C. So he suffered tremendously.
So their diet improves a little bit, thanks to Dr. Cook.
Yeah.
But they're there, like you said, it's treacherous to leave the ship. What do they do all day? And how do they keep from, you know, going just totally stir crazy? And besides, we're into the winter now, right? So is it dark around the clock?
It's dark around the clock because they're not quite at the South Pole. So they were at about 72 degrees south. So at that level, the sun doesn't rise for 70 days, but for much of that time, there's about an hour's worth of gloaming around the noon hour. But that certainly wasn't enough to lift their spirits. They started just as their bodies broke down from scurvy, their minds started to break down as well. I mean, there were a variety of factors that led to a kind of a profound depression that Cook said was not only a physical depression but a moral depression as well, which is a strange word for him to use. But even the ship's cat seemed to be suffering from the same despondency and died. Depression couldn't explain at all because there was also a very erratic heart rate. Complexions changed. People started experiencing strange cognitive symptoms, vertigo, dizziness, confusion, Cook called this polar anemia. He couldn't figure out what it was. It was a bit of a mystery, and we now think that it could have been something known as winter over syndrome, which we see to a lesser degree among wintering parties in Antarctica on research bases.
Is it seasonal affective disorder?
It is like an extreme version of that. Mm-hmm. And then certainly the lack of light was a factor. But so was the stir craziness, so was the despair, and so was the cold. Both the darkness and cold have effects on the thyroid hormone T3. And so it's believed that it could have been a form of hypothyroidism. Mm-hmm. But if you'll indulge me, you mentioned seasonal affective disorder, and one of Cook's remedies to this is he believed, especially from his time with the Inuit, he believed that the sun was all powerful, and he thought that the sun was as important, or the light was as important to human well-being as it was to the development of plants, and so he thought that the men could that their symptoms would be reversed if he could get enough light in their bodies. And since he couldn't bring the Belgica to the sun, he endeavored to bring the sun to the Belgica, in a manner of speaking, by making the men stand naked in front of a blazing fire for hours at a time, which was a rudimentary form of light therapy.
Right. And, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which in fact, the people who study that credit him with being it's the first known instance of light therapy, and he's credited as a pioneer of the field known as phototherapy.
We're speaking with Julian Sancton here on Constant Wonder. He's the author of Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Coming right up here on the show, how the crew finally escapes from the ice and Dr. Cook's second act as a con man who claims to discover the North Pole. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're speaking with Julian Sancton. He's the author of Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. So how long is the ship trapped, and does it stay intact?
More than a year. They were trapped in March of 1898. And so I think a total of 13 months. The pressure of the ice against the ship was a constant threat. The pack is in eternal movement, and it's affected by current and by wind. And even a small amount of wind over a sustained period of time can cause a tremendous amount of pressure to brace the ship and to crush it, almost like a boa constrictor kills its prey. And so every creak of the timbers, every moan of the ship. Inspired fear and terror in the men, because they knew that that was their only habitat and they were dependent on it. They knew what happened to the Jeannette, where many men died, and those who both in attempting to escape the ship and on the other side in Siberia of hunger. So this was the worst fate they could imagine, is being crushed by ice. And so it did end up surviving. There were a few cracks, a few strange noises, a few hissing sounds, even a fire that Amundsen put out immediately. But the ship stayed intact, and it was a well-built. It was the runt of the Norwegian whaling fleet. But the qualities that had attracted Dyrlashtar at the beginning were her nimbleness and the strength of her the wood that she was built with, which was greenheart wood, and it ended up withstanding the pressures.
Now, you said they were stuck there a year, though. Were they ever able to, like, get off the ship and exercise? Or, I mean,
well,
I have a hard time thinking what they did all day for a year.
Yeah. Cook insisted that they get out and exercise. In fact, he cleared a path around the ship for them to just walk around in circles, and he called it the Madhouse Promenade. A few more adventurous members of the crew, including him and Amundsen, would occasionally stray from the ship, but on only one occasion did Cook and Amundsen go further go far enough that they couldn't see the ship anymore, which was an incredibly dangerous thing to do.
Right.
Even though the pack looks like it's solid land, it's in constant flux, if you leave and then the fog, which is a constant threat, if the fog were to roll in, you could pass the ship by 300 feet and not see it, and then you'd be lost. Mm-hmm. So they were stuck to within a very narrow radius of the ship.
So they're stuck there for a year. The ship survives, though, you said, and they make it back to Belgium. When they arrive, how long have they been gone, and what's the welcome home like?
They'd been gone 2 years and change. Dyrlashtar had sailed the Belgica back almost on his own, him and a skeleton crew, back to Belgium. Everybody else made their own way back, but he was absolutely depleted. he was they every man after this this experience looked like they were 10 years older. Their hair was streaked with gray. I mean, their skin was they said the color of copper kettles because of how much they'd worked out in the sun trying to free the ship with ice saws. And he was a husk of his former self. Mm. He was afraid of what the reception was going to be. Having not reached the South Magnetic Pole, he would have come home to dishonor. But in fact, quite the opposite. His gamble had paid off. He was greeted as a hero, and the welcoming party, which included his parents, broke down in tears. It was fetid throughout the whole day. He was suffering horrible headaches. He was absolutely debilitated by these. And yet it was a glorious day for him. But several of the men who came back continued to suffer from the ordeal, almost as if the Antarctic had stayed with them, almost as if there's some, you know, malevolent force that is inimical to human life and that they took home with them. Mm. One, on the day of their arrival, suffered what may likely have been a heart attack aboard the welcoming committee's ship. Mm. And another died within a month. A Norwegian sailor died within a month. And one man went insane on the ice and never recovered his reason. And mm. for the rest of his long life was registered at a Norwegian asylum. Mm. So it's just the...
Well, two questions.
It was a harrowing story. Yeah.
Yeah. Did anybody die on the expedition, not make it back home?
Two people. One fell overboard during a storm. A young Norwegian cabin boy who was beloved by all and mm-hmm. was taken by the waves. And another, who was Dzhirlash's best friend, died of a combination of scurvy and this malaise, this polar anemia. He had a pretty weak heart, and in fact, Dzhirlash was knew about his frail constitution and didn't want to bring him on board, was afraid that he would not withstand the pressure. But it was either that or he was this friend of his, Emil Danko, was so thirsty for adventure that he said he would either go to the Congo or he would try his luck with Antarctica. And at the end, Dzhirlash relented, and sure enough, he met his fate in Antarctica. And this, his death caused Dzhirlash to start to really question why he had sailed into the pack ice. He had lost his best friend, and it's really then that the guilt struck him and stayed with him for the rest of his life. Mm.
And you said that they all suffered from some kind of lingering effects. Mm-hmm. Do we know why? I mean, could you attribute it to anything more than malaise?
Well, in Dzhirlash's case, I do put forward a theory, which is that it's related to Cook. So as instrumental as he was in saving the expedition, he also may have accidentally poisoned Dzhirlash, because he was the photographer of the expedition. And he, in teaching himself how to take photographs in this unusual environment, he ran out of the fixer known as hypo, which is mm-hmm. essential to develop photographs. And so he had read in an old copy of some British magazine that was lying around the ship that a prussic acid, also known as hydrocyanic acid, can be used as a fixer. It's extremely toxic, but it can be used as a fixer. And so they had some on board in order to kill animals to take back as specimens. And so he decided to try to make baths of these in the dark room. He would never stay long enough to breathe in the fumes, but the dark room had only one door, and that was into Dzhirlash's cabin. And so obviously the windows couldn't open in the Antarctic. Mm-hmm. And so all the fumes would waft into Dzhirlash's cabin, and it's very likely that the symptoms of cyanide poisoning, chronic cyanide poisoning, match up pretty closely with what Dzhirlash was experiencing. And so from erratic heart rates to headaches to confusion and dizziness. So there's a possibility that accounted for the 2 years that it took Dzhirlash to recover.
Mm. Well, I would like to kind of go off on a different tangent, which you've kind of referred to. And Cook, he's such a colorful character, and not content with this expedition under his belt, he wants to be known as someone more successful. And so he decides he's going to be the first to the North Pole.
Yes, and in the between his first expedition after the Antarctic, and he wrote a book about the Belgica called Through the First Antarctic Night, which made him kind of something of a minor celebrity. It sold very well, and his follow up to that was to ascend Denali, which was then known as Mount McKinley, the tallest mountain in North America, and he mounted two expeditions. During the first, he charted the base of Denali, and in fact, it was a quite an admirable effort. He was circumnavigated the entire mountain, which is no mean feat. The second year, he goes back and comes home, claiming that he had reached the top, and that he had written a book about that, which sold very well. So, again, this story of explorers making their money by telling stories and selling them, so which encourages lies or exaggerations. In 1909, after not hearing from Cook for 3 years, the world reads headlines claiming that Cook had reached the previous year had reached the North Pole, and had spent the following year camped out in the Arctic and surviving on walrus meat. And he had finally made his way back to civilization and claimed I've reached the North Pole. He was feted around the world, in Denmark, in New York. There were cocktails in his, designed in his honor. People started selling the Cook hat, which was a big dome of white fur, in honor of the North Pole. And, there were, you know, ticker tape parades. But within a few months, that even a few weeks, that people started doubting that record and that achievement. His arch rival Robert Peary, his former co-traveler, an American as well, claimed that he had reached the North Pole later, and his record was much more believable. And over time, both men's records actually turned out to be most likely fabrications. But Cook's was a much bolder fabrication; he didn't come close. And once they investigated that, people found out that he had forged or fabricated his summiting of Denali as well. And he had, from the heights of exploration, he became a national punchline. And the only people who were willing to listen to his lectures were vaudeville audiences. And so he decided to remake his career as an oil man. And eventually became an overnight success. He built a company of assembling a bunch of defunct oil concerns and selling shares to this newly formed entity. He made a company that was capitalized at $300 million in 1923 dollars. But that was soon found to be a Ponzi scheme. And essentially a Ponzi scheme. And he was thrown in jail sentenced to 14 years in Leavenworth Prison.
And, that seems like a long time.
He was punished, I suggest, and in fact, I'm not the only one to suggest it, that he was made an example of. His particular scheme in this oil business was, he was not the only one to do it. People trading on their notoriety to sell worthless shares. But because he had already bamboozled the public in other fields, the judge called him the Machiavelli of the 20th century and threw the book at him. So he was sentenced to 14 years, but he was just as he was the most popular man aboard the Belgica, he was the most popular man in Leavenworth, and he applied many of the skills that he had learned aboard the Belgica to Leavenworth, which he called later the coldest place on earth. This is a man, the first American to the Arctic and the Antarctic, calls Leavenworth the coldest place on earth. But even there was nutritional deficiencies among the inmates, and he found that his inmates were suffering from scurvy as well, and insisted they eat raw meat, and insisted that they have a time in the sun. And just he was at his most glorious when men depended on him. Mm.
And so the administration listened to him in prison and made
absolutely.
Some changes?
Yeah, he became the physician's assistant. He couldn't be the physician because he was an inmate, but essentially he performed the roles of the physician.
Huh.
And he was in charge of the hospital. And the one man who visited him among his friends in prison was Amundsen, who in the meantime had achieved his destiny of mm-hmm. becoming the most accomplished polar explorer of all time.
Oh, it's a very touching story. You opened the book with that of the contrast of the two, the fallen one fallen from grace and one at the height yeah. of his glory. That's kind of a beautiful contrast there.
Yeah.
Before we leave you, I would just like you to kind of tie a bow on this, because some of the things that they learned are still used by scientists today when they're planning to go to really forbidding places. So could you tell yeah. us a little bit about that?
Yeah. In fact, the way I learned about this story was that I'd read an article saying that NASA, in preparing for manned missions to Mars or long-duration spaceflight, is looking to polar expeditions as a precedent, as an analog, and particularly to the Belgica when it comes to the question of food and the role of the physician. So Cook, even though he became such a mountebank, such a con man later on in life, it serves as an inspiration in many ways to the people designing these far-flung expeditions. There's a NASA consultant named Jack Stuster who wrote a book called Bold Endeavors, Lessons from Space and Polar Exploration. And many of those lessons are derived from Cook, from his ingenuity, his adaptability, his resourcefulness, and the attention he paid to the men, his habit of making systematic psychological surveys of the men, and his recommendations for food, for maximizing the variety of food. All of these are recommendations that have made their way into NASA's, into Jack Stuster's recommendations for NASA. And so I find it particularly poignant that if and when we do reach Mars, we will in some small way have Cook to thank.
Well, Julian Sancton, I want to thank you for sharing this story with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Julian Sancton is the author of Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
Here on the show, we've spent a lot of virtual time in the Antarctic, actually, and there's probably a reason for it, I think. It's just that I'm inclined to prefer the virtual experience when it comes to this particular continent. Kind of cold down there, kind of foreboding. It's not for me. Aside from outer space, Antarctica is still one of the last great frontiers and much to be learned yet down there. Next, we are going to take a look at a more recent and less harrowing experience of an Antarctic filmmaker who also survived the long, dark Antarctic winter, but with much less danger and a whole lot more fun. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. The long polar night can produce madness in some people, they say. For some people, it's a place of beauty. We're going to turn now to a conversation with a filmmaker, a photographer, who back in 1991 took a team with him down into that seemingly eternal winter night, the bitter cold of the deep Antarctic, to capture scenes of beauty, I suppose, but also in that unforgiving region, to study the lives and film the lives of nesting emperor penguins. This was long before that movie, March of the Penguins. It was back in the day that you could call the Wild West in the deep, deep south. And along the way, yes, they met brave penguins, friendly whales, thieving birds. They learned to track climate change in layers of ice. Max Quinn is author of A Life of Extremes, The Life and Times of a Polar Filmmaker. Here's a highlight from my conversation with him.
it was the sort of project that you wouldn't be able to do these days because of health and safety requirements. But we were very fortunate and we were given permission to do it. And I had no researchers with me. They were just me, my sound operator. And each day, each time we went out to the colony, probably two or three helpers from Scott Base would go out with us to carry our gear and to look after us and to keep us safe. And we made over 13 trips out to that colony during the year, from the summer right through to the following summer, filming the various aspects of the incredible breeding cycle of the emperor penguin.
I'm so very glad that you mentioned that you were from summer to summer, because there's no way to be in transit to Antarctica during the winter season. You got down there in the warm season, the relatively warm season, and then stayed through the winter.
Yes, we did. Back in those days, this was 1991 when I did this, the only way to get down there was during the summer, and then the flights stop at about the end of February. Now, you must remember in the Southern Hemisphere, we're opposite to you guys up north, so for us, winter is June and July. That's the middle of winter. So by February, the summer in Antarctica is beginning to wrap up. And all of the planes are leaving, and only the small teams of winter overers are left down there to keep things ticking over during the winter, ready for the next summer season when all the scientists come back in. So we were just with a very small group of 11 people at Scott Base. And there was no, once the flights finished at the end of February, that was it until the sun returned at the end of August.
For what reason did you need such a prolonged stay there?
Because if you want to make a film about an animal, like an emperor penguin, you have to film the breeding cycle from start to finish. And that's an annual cycle. Like all things in life, it's an annual cycle. So in order to make a blue chip, sort of full-on natural history film about emperor penguins, you have to basically live with them for at least a whole year to see them right through their cycle. And with the emperor penguin, we knew that they feed up out on the sea ice during the summer. And then at the end of summer, they come in and form their huddle, which keeps them warm right through the winter. They are the only bird that has managed to evolve to stay in Antarctica. And the temperatures there can get really cold, like down to minus 50 degrees Celsius or even lower in Fahrenheit terms. They have evolved to live there and lay their eggs, believe it or not, at the coldest time of the year, and then hatch their chicks as the sun is returning in August. Quite a remarkable thing. And so what we had to do was to trip out there at the key moments of their breeding cycle and do the filming, because we were also living at Scott Base, and of course my company wanted to make the best use of me as they possibly could. So they had me making other films down there as well. So we had to travel back and forward. And that was quite a dangerous thing to do, as I describe in the book. All of those trips out to Cape Crozier in the dark of winter in our snow track vehicle with just spotlights trying to spot our way across the Ross Ice Shelf, avoiding crevasses. It was a very, quite dangerous, I suspect, but very dramatic thing for me to take on at that stage of my life.
I'm just surmising that you must have had weather reports, because before you say, okay, we're going to take a trip today, you've got to know if it's going to be a blizzard.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, blizzards down there catch you by surprise. The locals down there, they call them Herbies, and they just suddenly spring up all of a sudden. It's just like a little puff of wind, but it becomes a howling blizzard that might last only an hour or so, but they can be very dangerous and they can completely obliterate your view. So you have to be very careful. But yes, there were weather forecasts, which we would get from our own Met people. We had a couple of technicians down there keeping weather reports for us, but also we had weather reports coming in from the Americans at McMurdo Station as well. So we were able to sort of pick our moments to travel out there. But of course, we had to juggle this with the key times of the emperor penguin's breeding cycle, so that we knew that when they were forming their huddle, we wanted to be there to see that. When the eggs were being laid, we wanted to see that. So we had to be there at those critical times, otherwise we would miss it. And so it was a really a bit of a juggling act, you could say. as we went, slowly pieced the film together as we worked our way through the winter. And then, of course, by the during the winter, of course, it was virtually pitch black, and we were down there filming the eggs on the feet of the birds. It was just the most remarkable thing that I've ever experienced.
So you've got a camera with you, and you're going to be watching an egg hatch, an emperor penguin egg. How close are you? How close do you dare get? And how do you time that?
Quite difficult, really. When we first went down to the penguin colony, when the birds were just forming their huddle, they were a wee bit wary of us, so we kept our distance. But once they laid eggs, or once they had chicks on their feet, that was the focus of the birds, was on the chicks. And we found that we could get very close to them, and they were not concerned with us at all. So it became, in some respects, a lot easier once they had laid eggs for us to get up nice and close and get the big close-ups that we wanted.
Well, when you say close, how close is close?
I would say we generally try to keep about 30 meters away from the penguin huddle. But once the eggs had hatched, there were moments when I could feel confident enough to get down low on the ice and literally crawl right up to them, and they wouldn't be concerned. There were moments when, after the chicks had hatched, there would be what they call kidnappings, or the scientists call them chicknappings, whereby unemployed birds, or birds that didn't breed for any reason, want to get their hands on a stray chick. And little fights would break out in the colony. And on some occasions, they wouldn't be concerned about us. And on one occasion, this ruck of birds fighting over a chick, it was just the most horrific thing that you could imagine. They came crashing up against my tripod leg at one stage. That's how close that I got on that particular occasion. It wasn't by choice either. But generally speaking, we kept our distance. One of the things we had to be very careful of is that here we were down there in Antarctica with a penguin colony, just a small penguin colony. If we spooked those birds at any stage while they had eggs on their feet and they all rushed off and we scared them away and their eggs all fell off their feet and onto the ice, then all of those eggs would freeze pretty much instantly. So we had to be so careful. We took a really standoffish approach to how we approached those birds. And, I feel very proud of the fact that when the chicks finally hatched, it was one of the best chick hatching years that they had for many years, was the year that we were down there. So we were very, very, very careful.
Max Quinn is author of A Life of Extremes, The Life and Times of a Polar Filmmaker. Question for you, what's more of a challenge to deal with, a regular donkey or a wild donkey? Either one is likely to be a bit of a troublemaker, but feral donkeys digging up the desert may actually be doing something beneficial. We're going to learn about that next, and also about donkey therapy. That's therapy with, by, for, from, and in spite of a donkey named Sherman. It's a great story. Stay tuned for more Constant Wonder.